I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next. Today, we're going to be talking with Bob James. We've had Bob on before from Western New York Events, and also he is a former crisis services outreach worker. Bob, how you doing?
Yes, sir. I certainly am. Thanks for having us here today.
And Carolyn Damon with a supervisor at Spectrum Cares. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. And thank you for coming in to share. There's a special event coming up to assist mental health first responders. And Bob brought this to our attention. But Carolyn, I mean, you fully understand, you know, what this is all about in terms of, you know, what these workers, what they're called upon to do. Why don't you give us an outline of, you know, when we use the term mental health first responder, what are we really talking about here?
Well, from my perspective, I've done outreach work with adults, and I currently work in CARES with the 17 and under population. When you say mental health first responder, I like to think of ourselves as kind of the first layer anybody in the community, parents, counselors, school people can call if somebody is experiencing a mental health crisis and they don't know where else to turn. We're usually the ones that can go out and assess and make sure somebody is safe to remain in the community.
It's a big job.
It is a big job. Big job, big responsibility, but also big rewards.
And with that, Bob, I think what's prompted the idea of having a special event, a bit of a fundraiser to assist here with mental health first responders, but you also have your own experience in dealing with this, so you know what these individuals are going through.
Sure. You know, I've spent my whole life with a foot in music and a foot in social services and mental health, and I was an outreach worker back in the 80s at Crisis Services. I think they're called mobile workers now, or mobile outreach teams, but it was called an outreach worker back then.
But you like that term, mental health first responder?
Yeah, because I think one of the points of doing this event is everybody knows about police, they know about fire, they know about military, they know about ambulance drivers. Just as essential in the community are people that are having psychiatric or psychological or sometimes family domestic crises. They need help resolving it. And it's really an unrecognized asset in our community that there are people that go out 24/7, all kinds of weather, to respond, to provide interventions, an assessment and intervention on a crisis to help save lives. Sometimes it can be that essential, but also to help resolve things from getting much worse.
And we're looking forward to getting into maybe a little bit more about what that entails and some of the stories that I can only imagine that individuals have to contend with at another program here on What's Next. But you've got a special event coming up on May 22nd. And of course, we've talked to you previously about some of your music productions that you use to help benefit causes, especially with the local veterans as well. But in this case, what are we looking at here?
Well, since I had such a good, you know, kind of habit of over the last 8 years to develop a network of musicians that are willing to donate their time and their talent to raise money for veterans issues, it seemed like a natural outreach, since mental health is one of the primary needs that veterans need, is to actually look at the first responders that are unrecognized and trying to engage them in an event. So we put together a concert on the 22nd of May, and we got a whole bunch of musicians, and I'll run down the list when you're ready.
Go ahead. Give me the list, because I do know a couple of these names.
I'll be there with a guitar: Kathy Carfagna, Bob Kozak, Melissa Sowers, Dick Bowerly, George Paleo, Gretchen Schultz, David Meiser, Mr. Conrad, Pat Shaughnessy, Patty Parks, and Scott Milzak. Patty Parks is playing with her Patty Parks Band, and Dave and Kathy are playing with the Horizontal Stripes. That includes one of your buddies from Hamburg, mm-hmm. Bob Kozak.
One of the former jumpers, yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He's on the list. So they're all donating their time and their talent, and we're going to raise some money for Crisis Services and Spectrum Cares. So not only is it a collaboration with the music community, we put together like an arrangement between Spectrum Cares and Crisis Services to work together to promote, split the proceeds, and that kind of stuff. So very excited about this. And to me, I have, like I said, I have a very strong affinity to my experience as an outreach worker. And I wanted to use the assets that were developed through the Buffalo Blues and WNY Vets Project to support this cause.
And, you know, it's interesting that because it's not unusual to see these type of musical gatherings for good causes. Is there something special about the way these events come together? Is there something, a spirit that maybe emerges as the event goes on?
Well, for me, the motivation is usually personal. With the veterans issues, my dad was a World War II surgical technician, and he had to make those tough decisions about which injured would go to the surgeon, which injured would just get comfort care because they weren't going to make it. Hmm. And he was 21 years old when he had that experience. So that drives me to continue to do the support for veterans. How can we get veterans home? And getting home is a very complex matter when it comes to veterans that come home but aren't fully home and all that. That's a whole other conversation. But for the crisis services element, to me, it's like it changed my life in terms of I should knock on wood. There's never been a situation since I was an outreach worker that I've been kicked off balance in a crisis because I've saw and experienced so much helping resolve those kinds of issues that it actually made me very resilient. And I think Carolyn can speak to the same thing. It makes you very resilient in terms of your ability to manage almost anything.
Well, how about that? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think once you do crisis work, you're kind of prepared for anything life throws at you going forward.
Wow. Yeah. But at the same time, I would think that there's a certain amount of stress that goes along with it as well.
Definitely stress. But I think to go back to what Bob was talking about earlier, going out in teams of like two people, that I think helps to alleviate the stress because you have a partner with you at all times. You learn to become very reliant and dependent on each other, not just for each other's clinical skills, but for that emotional and mental support that you need while you're out there doing an assessment. So I think the way that we go out in teams kind of mitigates the stress a little bit.
At the same time, though, do you agree with Bob in the sense that, you know, this is a part of our community that maybe we don't necessarily know that much about?
Oh, for sure. I think unless someone actually experiences their own personal mental health crisis, a lot of times they don't even know that our services are out there and available to friends or family or neighbors or people that maybe they know that they're concerned about. So I think getting the word out and just making the community more aware of all that we have to offer for kids and adults, I think that's huge.
So the awareness is almost as a big a part of this event then, Bob, as raising the funds.
To me, it's more important, not that we don't want to raise the money for the organizations,
right,
but to increase community awareness of what this service is and who these people are. I think, let's say they're equally important, but I think it's an essential thing because they're not recognized. And very often, if you look at people's job satisfactions, the science of job satisfaction, it's recognition that comes before pay that people actually feel that fuels them to stay in the job. So this is an essential thing. And I think a lot of the people that I experienced in the outreach field don't really need the recognition. They don't really want the recognition, but I think they benefit from getting recognized that they're heroic, because there are some heroic things that happen in these kinds of outreach visits that you have to do 24/7, all kinds of weather, all over the city. It's transformative for the client, but also for the worker themselves.
You know, I saw you nodding your head there emphatically as Bob was talking about.
I saw that too.
How the recognition isn't important, but yet there's a benefit to it.
Absolutely. I don't think any of us that do this work get into it to be recognized
or
for doing
money.
It. Yeah, or, you know, get rich.
Right.
But I think having somebody see what you're doing and giving you that kind of kudos and recognition, like Bob said, is important because it's kind of the fuel to keep you going, you know, to know that somebody notices what you're doing.
Right, right. And so let's make sure that we hit all the major points here, though, Bob, about this fundraiser. Again, it's Wednesday, May 22nd.
Yeah, at the Cave, and there's the Cave Buffalo has a website where the tickets are available. But you could also find Mental Health First Responders event page on Facebook, and the Crisis Services and Spectrum also has their own Facebook pages. $10 at the door, buying tickets in advance helps us anticipate who's going to be there. We're going to have somebody from the VA tabling and, you know, talking about the services that the VA offers. We also have somebody from Spectrum that's going to be tabling as well. And I think they're going to be handing out some Narcan education.
So. Oh, wow.
Life saving. So it's going to be informative. It's going to be very musical and a lot of fun. And the other thing you had asked about is what makes it unique. These events allow musicians that know each other to get on stage together. Mm. As opposed to going out and seeing each other's bands. We put together these mixtures of musicians that usually don't share the stage to do it. To me, as a musician, that's one of my favorite things for these kinds of events.
Kind of an all-star evening of sorts. And you get to see Bob James play.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Well, there's a bunch of people here that are inducted into the Buffalo Music Hall of Fame. So we go for the best.
Very good. Bob, Carolyn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome to What's Next. Today, we're talking with Will Green. Will has been on this program before. He's at UB. He's the Assistant Dean of Outreach and Community Engagement for the Graduate School of Education. His business is Tremonti Solutions. Will, thanks for coming back.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Always appreciate the conversation here and also the fact that you can join us as we reflect a lot on May 14th, 2022. Here 2 years later in Buffalo. And there's a lot to get into in that regard. Let's maybe just, if you can reflect back, take us back to 2 years ago, what that was like for you, if you don't mind going through those moments again.
Yeah. And, you know, I can't pinpoint exactly where I was when I learned about it. What I do remember, and I guess this is a sign of the times, what I do remember is finding out about it. Of course, there's people texting me and sending links. So finding out, like getting the graphic images through my cell phone and thinking to myself, I don't want to see another video.
Right.
You know, that's what sticks out to me about the incident. Just how shockingly graphic and available those images were, and people's propensity to share those images, almost knee-jerk reaction, because we live in a society where everyone wants to show everything. And knowing that, there's a cost to that, right? There's a cost to that, because once you see something, you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
So that's what I remember, the instantaneous moment, first hearing about it and those graphic images coming through and just the shock of, man, people are sharing this widely. Like, I don't think we should be sharing this. I don't think this should be out here like that.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just follow that just a little bit. The idea that we are in that time where that happens, does it, as best you can understand, did it change how the community, or maybe just the people looking in on this event from the outside, do you think it changed the way they took it in? I'm just curious about your perception on that. I haven't really necessarily thought of it. Like you said, like, you're right, that was out there everywhere. Real quick, obviously, you know, the perpetrator had a lot to do with that, of course.
Yep.
But I'm curious, you know, about that. I mean, do you have a sense about how people took that in? Maybe perhaps more violently, perhaps more stunningly, or is there that sense of maybe, well, it's something that happened there?
Yeah, you know, so I haven't had that specific conversation with people about, you know, the graphic sharing of the information, because that's a larger conversation.
Sure.
I think we see so much of that. I think that's one of those situations where those particular seeds were planted and we won't know what's harvested as a result of that for years to come.
Hmm.
I think certainly it leads to people being desensitized to violent images. I think certainly it may have the opposite effect on individuals, but I think we don't know. I certainly don't know what will be the long-term impact, but I think just now we live in an age where if something happens, we're going to see it, whether we want to see it or not. You don't have to necessarily click the link, but I know that was definitely the intention of the young man who, you know, did these heinous acts to put it out there. And I'm sure there are people afraid. And I have had conversations about folks in the aftermath. And it's not specifically about the incident and the sharing of the graphic images, but just, you know, how they feel post-tragedy.
Maybe let's talk about that a little bit. You know, when you said about fear, I mean, that was something that I've had people sit right in this studio tell me, again, maybe didn't go out the house for days afterwards. And they didn't necessarily have to see these videos to feel that way. I think it said something about, you know, the historical realities of Buffalo and Buffalo's East Side to a certain extent, that, you know, there's something out there and there's something worth fearing.
Yeah. So I think I represent maybe a segment of the population, especially the Black community on the East Side of Buffalo, who knew that that type of monster existed. I mean, we talked earlier about my experiences in school settings. And for me, I can closely relate my experiences as a young Black man in school and openly saying, why don't they like me with an incident like this? That there are folks who don't like me, who hate me because of how I look, how I sound, how I speak. So to hear that there was a racist shooting, quite honestly, didn't surprise me. It's the same as Donald Trump being elected president, where so many other people are shocked. Like, how could they elect a person like that? I'm like, that's the America that I know.
Right.
This is the America that I know. And I know historical incidents that have happened that look just like this racist shooting. So I wasn't surprised. I was not afraid to come outside of my house because I'm a Black man in America.
You've lived this.
I know what I'm dealing with every day, and I know the possibilities that could happen. For me, I think something that troubled me, and I'll get to, you know, I participated in a healing circle at the Resiliency Center on Jefferson. And what it did is gave me perspective of other individuals. So for me, I was removed. I wasn't there in the moment. I do feel a sense of anger because of the lack of power that incident represents for my community. This individual was able to come, case out the space, talk to individuals, move freely, you know, put together a plan, and then act it out, right? And you're shooting elders and defenseless people. And my community had no way to defend itself in that moment. And that's historically, right?
Right.
That's historically. But when I participated in the healing circles, they were individuals, and I was so blessed to be in that space with them and blessed to experience the strength and courage that they displayed in retelling their stories, seeking a sense of healing and, in a way, empowerment, taking control of it. But those individuals, and I won't share much about what they said.
Sure.
They were there on the site when it happened. Mm. They saw the shooter. They saw the violence in the aftermath. And what I noticed about those individuals is none of them stayed in the neighborhood. They said, we had to move.
Wow.
And they didn't live together. They were separate individuals talking about their own separate stories. But the one thing they said is that I couldn't stay there anymore. I couldn't go in the store anymore. And for me, it is about a lack of power in the community. But to hear their stories, for them, they're not thinking about power. They think about healing.
Right.
They're afraid. They're permanently traumatized by this incident. And then that does bring me back to power, because now it's great that we have these healing circles and we can talk about it. But where does the power come in? Where's the power in turning that space into a space of healing? It's now a space of commerce in which it had been before, as if the incident didn't happen. And I understand that a memorial was being planned, and I get that. But for me, taking ownership and control means something completely different. Now, people will say, oh, but they need a grocery store over there. Well, if we trace back why there's no grocery store over there, then it goes back to power.
Right.
So for me, it's all about power, the lack of power, how we have influence to make decisions. And in the aftermath, I don't see any community power being exacted by the individuals on the ground, by those people who participate in that healing circle. How do we get them to a place of power to deal with the trauma?
You've got some deep thoughts about this, and I'm not surprised, and I appreciate you sharing. So let's maybe look at that to a certain extent. 2 years later, the power dynamic hasn't changed?
I mean, so the power dynamic is it's got depth and breadth, right? So there's local, familial, community, and I would say looking at it from the sense of the city and where this tragedy happened, I really don't necessarily see the power dynamic changing. I certainly see more movement in the area and organizations saying we're going to reclaim Jefferson and coming in, and there's outpouring of resources. But you know, being who I am and being someone who has studied the plight of African Americans, Black people in America, what's interesting to me is that we get more of the same remedy for symptomatic issues as opposed to dealing with the root cause. So the response is to bring in more self-help supports, more human services institutions. I have to challenge that and say, but who owns them?
Right.
I have to challenge that and say, how was that empowering a community? How was that recirculating income within the community? So at some point, Tops is not the only supermarket within the community. How do we encourage home ownership and ownership of the land and activities that build up the strength and internal resources of a community so we don't need human service organizations?
Right.
I being who I am, I have to ask those questions.
And they're great questions. There is conversation about some of those elements, community ownership, bringing, you know, trying to keep the wealth in the neighborhood, have the neighborhood reflect that. Yeah. But in terms of policy development, have we seen anything that leads you to believe that there might be solutions coming along the that, you know, maybe there's a spirit, but is it showing any kind of concrete reality?
So the last time I was here, we were talking about a discussion about white rage, a white rage right. panel discussion within the context of employee relations and work. And in that discussion, I tend to go off script sometimes.
That's why.
In that discussion, I raised the question, because they were talking about creating safe workspaces and these things. And I'm like, well, you know what? Because as an educator, one of the things I always do, especially with my business, is I like to ask people who say they know how to turn around schools. Have you ever worked in a high functioning classroom? Have you ever worked in a high functioning school? Have you ever worked in a high functioning school district? Have you ever seen it? Have you ever experienced it? So at the panel, I asked the question, well, we want these spaces. Do you know what it means to have an empowered Black community? What does that look like? And you get a pause because we haven't seen it. When we talk about a high functioning community that is existing similar to other high functioning communities where they don't have to deal with certain issues because they are empowered, I think that we need to have more creativity and double down on what needs to happen in historically Black communities to change the circumstances. And it's gonna be policy. It's gonna be changing what the people look like who come in and show up every day to change those policies. Fannie Lou Hamer, perfect example, right? So Fannie Lou Hamer, sharecropper in the South, she ran into Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, for the voter registration movement, and she became an icon. She became an icon and one of the most vocal leaders from the South for change in her community. Had the gold tooth and the country talk, didn't have more than a third grade education, but people connected to her immediately. A titan of the movement, the civil rights movement. But we hear very little about
her. Correct, right.
Grassroots. Where are those individuals in our community? How can we uplift them? Because too many times we have people who work in spaces like me coming and making decisions for that part of the community? How do we engage the part of the community that no one wants to talk to? And we can't say that they don't exist, because my experiences have always shown me that when I come in looking like that part of the community that doesn't make people feel comfortable, I face resistance.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll tell you, since I like coming and sharing my stories of education and putting some of my past teachers on blast, I'll tell you about my high school football coach.
Yeah,
Bill Boyle won a championship. I just got to tell it how it is. Being an educator, I always want to make sure that my students tell positive stories about me. So looking at my experiences and reviewing how they shaped my mindset. Remember, I told you, being the person that I am, I have to challenge some of these notions because of my experiences. Bill Boyle, when I talked to him about my ability as a football player, and if somebody came up to the field, oh, we want to talk to the best footballer, he would send me out to talk to him. All right. But he would question my friendships. So my very good friend, Antoine Morrow. Antoine, I know you're not listening, but I love you, brother. Completely turned his life around. Great man. Great man. He was my brother. And why you hang out with guys like that? Why we both go to Hutch Tech.
Wow.
We both go to Hutch Tech.
Yeah.
Antoine could, man, that was a very intelligent brother. We did work together, school work together. And, you know, he pulled me out before game day, because I come up there with Antoine, we caught the bus, and he pulled me out. Why are you hanging out with guys like that? You know, you could do so much more. Da-da-da-da. And Antoine was a dark-skinned brother, you know? And I'm just like, what? In my mind, mind you, I'm 15, 16. This is a grown man
right. Challenging
me like this, not knowing anything about where I come from. And the one thing I thought in my head is like, man, you don't know nothing about me, because when I was about to get jumped by 10 dudes, Antoine stood right next to me and did not run. He was going to take that whooping with me. Now, because we stood together, I didn't get jumped. But see, I was like, yeah, you come from a different world than me. You don't understand
right. What's
happening. And that's really like how they shape you and mold you. Like, okay, turn your back on these people. Turn your back on your community, because you can get so much more. I'm blessed to say that I've achieved the things that I've achieved by staying true to who I am and true to the people from the community. And every time a kid like that has come across my path, I was sure to encourage them and encourage them to love who they are and what they look like and where they come from.
Well, that's an incredible story. And also, it carries a whole set of questions with it as well. That type of message that you're talking about right there, I mean, I think I could probably picture a coach, an older individual, you know, thinking that, you know, the cliche, something that, you know, maybe they saw on a TV show or something, you know, you can't be with so-and-so because they're going to lead you on the wrong path. They're going to try, you know, not understanding the human connection. Do you think that attitude, though, is changing? You're talking about when you were in high school. Now, that's you've dated yourself to me already a few times. But then we're talking a decade or two ago. All right. So do you think that that attitude is leaving or has left the educational space?
So let me fully connect the dots.
OK.
That, right. Because one could say, oh, well, he was just looking out for your best interest. Maybe this young man was involved in things he shouldn't have been doing, and he sees potential in you, and he's trying to help you do better.
Perhaps, yes.
Well, upon graduating from high school, there were two coaches that I talked to. One coach, Dennis Green, shout out to Dennis Green, who recruited me to go to Alfred University. When I got there, he told me, he's like, your coach told me you weren't going to graduate. I'm like, what?
Whoa.
Then there was another coach from St. John Fisher who said, yeah, he says you're the best player, but you're not going to graduate. So if you're looking out for my best interest, and one of the easiest ways for me to get out of the space that I'm in is through athletics. And I've done everything I needed to do to play the sport, kept my grades up enough to be on the team and do well. If you were really looking out for my best interest, why would your message be, he's not going to graduate, when I was not in danger of not graduating? So there was an underlying theme to his behavior.
Right.
If I just tell half the story, it could be in the movie version. He's looking out for me. He's trying to save this young man from the dregs of the community.
Right.
No. The underlying theme was,
he didn't believe in you.
Nope. Didn't believe in me. Probably didn't like me. So I think That's what we have to be careful of, is that people who say we want to make things better for the community without making things better for the people who live in the community. That's a very different thing. That's a very different thing. We could clean up the community, but what happens to the black folks? Right? How have they benefited? Because remember, the impetus for all the influx of resources was a racist shooting.
Right.
A young man who hated black people specifically does what we do to fix that, mirror what needs to happen for black folks to be triumphant in the space that they live and be empowered and do the things that take control of their lives.
And the simple answer right now is not happening?
I haven't seen that.
Right.
Now, what I do see is, oh, well, we had this meeting and nobody showed up. Why aren't they showing up? As a teacher.
And you would understand that as somebody, like you said, you come into that space at times dressed as the professional. You're the professional and you get resistance. Even though you understand, you've lived it, you understand the experience, you're saying that you still get, you get resistance. So there's definitely, I mean, I'm putting words in your mouth and I apologize for it to a certain extent, but there's still a very significant disconnect between what is considered, whatever, you know, authority, official, whatever term you want, and what is really happening among the people of this community.
I mean, I think, you know, you have what I would say is situations within the black community that breaks our hearts. And how many times can your heart be broken before you lose faith in the people who are supposed to be representing you? So too often we say, well, we tried to get them to come, but they didn't show up. It's because they're empathetic. They're apathetic. They don't want to be involved. And we write it off. As a classroom teacher, I could never write a student off. I could never say, man, why isn't this kid showing up? Why isn't this kid getting it? I had to do more. And if I was unable to do more, it wasn't that the kid failed. I failed as a teacher. I think we need a little bit of that. I think we need a little bit of, you know what? We're not going to go down without engaging. And there are ways to make it happen. But it takes a little bit more effort. One of the things we talk about is this work isn't easy. If it is easy, you're probably not doing it right. And making excuses about why people aren't showing up to the table is easy.
Yes, absolutely. We're talking with Will Green today on What's Next. Will at UB is the Assistant Dean of Outreach and Community Engagement for the Graduate School of Education. His business is Tremonti Solutions. The overview of Tremonti, if you don't mind. I mean, we talked about it a little bit before we went on the air, but I just want to make sure that we have an understanding of the type of work that you're doing in schools with Tremonti Solutions.
Yep. So essentially, I work with schools in attempting to resolve racial and cultural conflicts. Usually, it's after something, an incident has happened, and the school district decides or the individual school decides that a employee needs some support.
So you get called in after the fire has already started?
Yes. Yes. And it's interesting work. There is a certain level of anonymity, you know, but I think when I sit down and engage staff, teachers about an incident that's happened, it's something that is exhaustive because we have to talk about a lot of things like identity, like power, like, you know, emotions behind it. And what's interesting is there are blind spots. Some folks do have blind spots. And it's very interesting because it's based on Socratic method. So I cannot guide them towards anything. All I can do is ask them to retell the story, identify the key individuals in the story, look at who those individuals are through those lenses that I just mentioned, and then ask them questions about the incident. Ask them, what could they do something? If they had a chance to go back in time and do something different, what would it look like? And then we kind of peel that down to something realistic, give them an opportunity for reconciliation. If they choose to take it, they can. If they don't, that's on them.
You know, one of the themes of our programming this week on What's Next is to look at the challenges that face the East Side. And just to hear you talking about that, you're getting, when you're in those situations, you're getting, I think, a real understanding of the real challenges, that there are attitudes, historically embedded attitudes, that I mean, I don't want to say insurmountable because I don't want to utilize that. But I'm wondering, as you're going through that, if you just see, like, this is just one person. And this person mm-hmm. may not even be, we'll put a scale, not that bad or whatever. Mm-hmm. Knowing that there are people that would be lower on that scale. I guess I'm asking you is, when you see that, you obviously are going to contend with the challenge and try to take it on. But how do you verbalize the challenges that you see in those moments?
I mean, when it's a one-on-one situation and, I'm in my bag, so to speak, right. and I'm really operating at a high level with, and the individual is forthcoming with what they share.
Right. Most?
You know what? They are.
That's
because
that's great
to hear. The incidents are usually something that the people who are ordered to protect those individuals tell them not to talk to anyone.
Mm.
So usually when I come in, the most that has happened is a representative has done the speaking for them to maintain certain things within that profession or,
The guidelines that are within that
right,
space.
Right. I'm trying not to say stuff.
Right. Understood. You know. Yeah.
So they usually have a representative. They don't get a chance to tell their story.
Right.
Because they're saying, no, don't. Even if it's like, oh, no, I really, I want to share this. And, no. We're going to just take care of A, B, C. And if we get to C, great, good to go. And you sign off on it. And then here we are.
Yeah.
So the people that participate in these, they're really forthcoming about what has happened. They share a lot. And part of it is, describe the setting. The setting isn't just what happened in the moment. It's everything that has led up to the moment. The setting could exist beyond one day in 10 years, your whole experience as an educator, right? So they share so much information. And I have to be really astute in capturing that information, because when we get to the retelling of the story and challenging the conflict, I have to ask them questions about how they describe themselves, how they've described other individuals, and hold that up with their actions. And most of the time, a wonderful thing happens. It's an aha moment where I ask a question that brings their actions and who they identified as together. And they're like, that's not who I am.
Mm.
That's not who I want to be. That was something that was harmful. I told this person that I'm a mentor. I told this person that students can come to me for help. And in that moment, that was not helpful. In that moment, I tried to have an adult conversation with a kid using language that if I used with an adult, it would be a fight. I inflicted my power on that kid in that moment and got offended when they challenged me. Like, you could literally see it happen. And it's a wonderful moment. But there are also moments when I see the retraction. When I ask that question, and their eyes get wide and then they shrink back because they're like, oh, what did you just do to me? You made me think about my actions and behaviors and I almost changed. It's an exhausting experience because when you see people willingly deny themselves right. that inner discussion, it's like, yeah. So is there hope? Yeah, I think we can do it one by one.
Right.
And it's not one thing. So as an educator, I believe in the transformative power of education. I believe that no person is incapable of change through knowledge, learning, and understanding. So it's all one person. And then, we get to 10 and forget mathematics. 1 + 1 isn't 1, or 1 + 1 isn't 2. It is 1 because we are thinking the same. We're moving along the same direction. So it's just the right people at the right time thinking the right things.
It's great. And I love to hear the hopeful element of that. And like you said about education, I'm just curious about your opinion. When you hear political rhetoric, I can only think that that has got to exasperate your enthusiasm for this. No?
I mean, I love to watch Meet the Press. I love the questioning, and I love the ability to take a question and turn it into something else. I think those are skills and tactics. It doesn't take away from the mission. I heard Denzel Washington say, if you don't watch the news, you're uninformed. If you watch the news, you're misinformed. Right? But that's where critical thinking comes
right.
in. You know, you take this information, you don't take it as law, you hold it up to your experience, you do additional research, you talk to other individuals, you find out about both sides, and then you make a decision. Then you make a decision. So I think politicians will politic. Decisions will be made, but the true power of politicians is within the people. If we inform people and allow them and encourage them to take on this process of taking in information, holding it up to what you know, looking at what you're experiencing and make a decision, then we can do something. But I think right now we got kind of like we're in a holding pattern. There are a lot of people fed up with the politics. I'm not fed up. It's a system. It's a tool.
You see it, like you said, critically. You see it as something that's just, it's been this way. It's just that the words sound different. Maybe the emotion's a little different right now.
Yeah. I think, you know, folks have the company line. Mm-hmm. So they know what they should say, what they can't say. And I think folks are adept at shifting the narrative in the direction that it needs to go to benefit them being elected and to benefit the party. I'm more concerned with the benefit of the people.
Right.
I'm more concerned with the benefit of the people. And I think, you know, being involved in politics is an essential a part of being a U.S. citizen.
Right? No doubt.
So we should be a part of it. But I do understand having two choices that equate to no choice.
Right.
I understand that. So I think the better informed we are, the more we could do to produce our own homegrown politicians. We talk about empowerment. Do we have homegrown community politicians from the east side of Buffalo representing the will of the people? The Fannie Lou Hamer, who may come in looking a little bit different. They don't wear a sports coat.
Right.
But they are anchors in their community.
In a lot of ways, we've kind of talked about indirectly about the resilience the community has shown in the last 2 years. But maybe I'll let you expand on it. Resilience is nothing new for the east side of Buffalo, right?
Absolutely. Nothing new for Black people in America.
Right.
I definitely sometimes have to take issue with resilience. When people say, oh, well, you got to be more resilient. I'm like, who is more resilient than Black people in America? I appreciate you asking this question because I thought about this earlier. I've been thinking about this a lot. So I was born in Buffalo. I lived in the university part of the east side, Kensington Bailey area. I remember when Bailey was a thriving strip and there were businesses and there were some Black-owned stores. Then mother and father were divorced. We moved with my grandparents and they lived still in Kensington Bailey area, but right on the edge. My grandfather, shout out to Sam Hargrove.
Sam.
He bought a house on K in Eggert, which was still Buffalo, but he was the first Black person to buy a home there. He told me stories about some of the things that he had to deal with in living there, but this was a tough man. This was a tough man. Right. This was a tough man, and he dealt with it. Then we moved from there when I was about 12 years old to Humboldt Park area, Northampton and Marshall Kerr area, and that was an experience. Now, I remember going from upper middle class Black folk area, Kensington Bailey area, two cars, house, to seeing this transition of now divorce rates increasing, drugs coming into the communities, and seeing the impact of we had community football games. I was playing football at 13 years old. I was playing football with 20 and 30 year olds, grown men, but I earned my chops. You know? But then the game started to dwindle, and that's the elevation of the drug era, right? So now, oh, we got some money out here. We can go get money. We don't have time to play football. And I saw the shift and the change in the proliferation of weapons in the community. I saw all these shifts, and it's like, okay, I'm growing up through this, and I'm seeing now drugs in the community, biological warfare, AIDS, all these things, and I'm looking at the young men in my community all the way till now when I'm going away to college, and where are they going, and are they coming back mentally fit? because they're going to prison, they're going to fight in wars. And I'm looking now from my community, there's a few young men left. A few young men left. Now, in other parts of the world, they got a name for that. That's a war. That's a proxy war within my community. Now, people can challenge the notion if they want to, but the end results are the same. The men in my community were wiped out.
Right.
Wiped out. Wiped out. My community was full of young men. Weren't a lot of young girls there. Trust me, I know. We kept very busy with sports because there was literally nothing else to do.
Okay.
And now look at now. It's like, oh, in the aftermath, the young men are gone. The men are gone. They can't be grandfathers like I am because they're gone.
Right.
And those who are still here have been traumatized by those experiences, did not get the benefit of going away to school and getting in contact with Black historians, learning about the history, learning about the oppression, becoming an educator and meeting quality Black educators to tell me who I was and what my experiences in high school meant. Why I was being treated like that, so I didn't internalize it. I knew that this was a systematic approach to who I was, an attack, a war. And now we talk about resilience. When I'm a survivor of a proxy war, that when I have conversations with the majority of people, say, that's not war. You brought that upon yourself because you don't know the history. You haven't done the study.
Hmm.
Right? So when we talk about resilience, it's like, I got some 14-year-olds that could tell you a lot about resilience if I could give them the words and show them what their experiences mean and the fact that they still get up every day and try. You know, do we need more resilience? I take a lot of money. Our community doesn't need more resilience.
Right.
We could write a book on resilience if we had the tools to be our own publisher. What could the community produce if we didn't get these soft skill approaches to symptomatic issues?
Soft skill, expand on that if you don't mind.
We get resilience. We get healing. We never get empowerment. When we get empowerment, it's filtered through something else. I think one of the interesting things, you know, I participate in those employer engagement conversations. And, you know, we look at private industry and we know at the top of private industry in the CEO positions are white men. I think what's interesting is that when you get to the higher earning, not-for-profit industry, at the top are white people.
Right.
It's very interesting. Now, some of the lower rung not-for-profit industry or organizations, you have Black and brown people as executive directors. But the higher you get in terms of income and the money that's filtered through those systems, the lighter and lighter the people who control them are. What does that tell us about the systems to address a lack of power? At the end of the day, in America, it is capital and the ability to change your surroundings based on capital. So what type of investments can we make in a community that has never had the economic power, economic capital? How do we start to generate conversations and discussions that envision a free and empowered Black community? Because we got to have that conversation because we don't know what it looks like. We got to have that conversation.
Well, there's a lot there. And I guess that takes us to the reform concept. Like you said, we can have talks about soft skills. I like the way you put that. And that's it puts a lot of things in perspective. So, capital. I mean, when you get right down to it, empowerment and money, they are, if they're not the same thing, they're very similar. Or they most certainly are in the same neighborhood.
Absolutely in America, for sure.
Yeah. All right, no doubt about it. So, and again, like you said, you know, have these conversations that can envision something that's a little different, or a lot different, actually.
Yep.
You know, I mean, where for you do you start? I mean, when you use your imagination, where does it take you? You know, how does it look?
So, number one is willingness, right? Are we willing to recreate the conditions that afforded other communities the ability to access wealth? Because as you start to go through history, you find out like, man, there was a whole bunch of giving stuff away going on.
Right.
Like, seriously, there's a whole bunch of, go ahead. If you get there, you can have it. And we'll give you more to build on top of that. And I won't get into details, but I think that's an essential question that needs to be asked.
Okay.
if we look at historically how other communities have garnered their wealth post-slavery, are we willing to do that for a community that has been disenfranchised historically? Another thing is I got to uplift Oshai Foundation.
Okay. All right.
Oshai Foundation has taken a revolutionary stance on their strategic plan and moving forward and saying that they are going to focus on economic empowerment for the east side of Buffalo and the historical Black residents. When I heard it, I almost fell out my chair because I've never heard anything like that anywhere.
Right.
Right. And they are doing the work. I'm a part of the Oshai Fellows, Karen Lee Spaulding, Leaders of Color. There are five cohorts right now, over 170 participants. And what we're starting to do with this knowledge of the new strategic plan is start to figure out exactly what you asked. Well, where do we start? Where do we go? There are a number of things happening around the country where cities are looking at what does it mean to give a guaranteed income.
Right.
Martin Luther King talked about that in his last book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. These are not novel ideas. I think what would be novel is that we're going to specifically focus on Black residents. Now, what I ask you is this: look at how people are interpreting Oshai's new strategic plan and mission. I don't necessarily care what naysayers have to say because I'm too busy doing the work.
Right.
But I think there's a lot of exposing how people truly feel about an empowered Black community. This notion that, well, if we give them something, we're going to lose something. I always push back and say, when in America has Black Americans ever gotten anything that didn't benefit everybody else? All you got to do is look at it.
Right.
So for me, where does this start is finding those people who understand all these dynamics. I think Oshai certainly has the resources and the funding. But if we don't, this is a one-shot deal, right? This is a one-shot deal because there's so many naysayers that are waiting for it to fail,
right,
praying for it to fail, that it's a one-shot deal. So what we have to do is be strategic in what we uplift. To me.
Well, Green, we're winding down here. This has been an amazing conversation. I always want to fall back on certain questions that I ask frequently, but I find in your answers already that you've answered a lot of those questions. That being stated, though, you're talking about the Oshai Foundation. I mean, it almost sounds like the way you're describing it, that we're at a tipping point, that it's now or never to make a difference that can transform the city. And you know, because I think if you transform and uplift the east side, you'll have I think we all love the city in its own way for all its faults, but there's a whole place where this area could go if this part of the community was uplifted, if it found some of the answers that you're talking about here. Am I overstating when I say that we're at a tipping point?
Yeah, I think because of the history of this country, we're always at the edge of a tipping point.
Okay.
I mean, because I think some of these things that keep folks occupied are fragile. They're very fragile. I mean, look at what happened with COVID. One shift, one change where people don't have, and then you start to see some really significant incidents in which folks are looking for something. But could Buffalo be a model? Absolutely. I mean, we're a model for all of the negative things. I mean, in terms of poverty rates.
Segregation,
absolutely. So Buffalo could be a model. I'm not necessarily focused on being a model. I'm focused on the preservation of a community. Do I think that Buffalo could benefit from that? Absolutely. Why is Buffalo not the go-to area for the Underground Railroad? Like, how are we not promoting that? Anyway, that's another conversation.
That's right.
But there's so much here. There's right. So much talent here. I've been lucky to travel outside of the city and kind of compare how people are from Buffalo versus everybody else. In Buffalo, we have heart. We got heart. So I guess we do have that resilience that you're talking about.
Right.
I think it's an opportunity. And is it now or never? I feel like that urgency needs to be placed there. But we had a conversation earlier about time not being linear.
Right.
I think the opportunity will come around again. Certainly not in my lifetime. But the question is, what do we do with what we have in our lifetime?
Will Green, I so appreciate your time with us today. Will Green is the UB Assistant Dean of Outreach and Community Engagement at the Graduate School of Education, and also his business, Tremonti Solutions. Will Green, thanks for joining us on What's Next.
Thank you. Appreciate the thought-provoking questions.
Thank you. This is What's Next on WBFO.